I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. William Porter, one of the police officers charged in Freddie Gray's arrest and death, took the stand in his defense yesterday. We get an update on the cross-examination of Porter and on the testimony of another Baltimore police officer involved in Gray's initial arrest. Up first, we welcome State Senator Catherine Pugh, continuing our conversations with Baltimore's 2016 candidates for mayor. We'll talk about education. Pugh helped found the Baltimore School of Design in Station North. And we'll talk about reducing violent crime. She's co-chair of the General Assembly's Public Safety and Policing Workgroup. Share your questions for Senator Catherine Pugh on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you are with us. Later this hour, we'll check in with Kenneth Burns of the WIPR reporting staff. He's in court this morning covering the trial of Officer William Porter, one of the Baltimore police officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Up first, though, State Senator Catherine Pugh is with me today in the studio as we continue our conversations with candidates to be mayor of Baltimore. Catherine Pugh is a Democrat with 2 decades of public service. Originally from Norristown, Pennsylvania, Senator Pugh came to Baltimore to attend Morgan State University. After working in banks, she entered public service as Director of Citizens Involvement under former Mayor William Donald Schaefer. Later, she served on the Baltimore City Council from 1999 to 2004. She was appointed to the House of Delegates, and the next year, 2006, she won a seat in the state Senate, where she is now majority leader. And Catherine Pugh is also president of the National Black Caucus of State Legislators. Do you have questions for Senator Catherine Pugh? You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. If that's a long-distance call for you, we have a toll-free number. That number is 866-661-9309. Or, of course, you can always send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Senator Pugh, welcome to Midday. Welcome back to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you for the invite.
Why do you want to be mayor of Baltimore? You got a great job in the state Senate.
You know, I think that what the city needs is a visionary leader, one who looks at how the city needs to operate more like a business and that can create the transparency and the accountability that the city needs. I think also that my experience, when you talk about the great job as a majority of the leader at the Senate, I think I was a great city council person as well. And I believe in public service, but I believe that I am the person who can knit us all together so that we can move Baltimore forward. And with my experience as a city council person, my experience as a business person, my experience as a media person, as well as at the state level and the national level, and as well as the international level, that I will be able to bring the resources to the city to help us build businesses in the city, to create opportunities, to leverage resources that the city needs. When you talk about some of our crime issues, when you talk about some of our housing problems, our transportation issues, I think I'm that person. When the President Barack Obama invited me to sit with him and the First Lady, in during the State of the Union address, he said it was because of the work that I've done nationally and as well as at the state level.
Right. And my comment about this, the Senate Majority Leader being a great job, is that you can get things done in the General Assembly. What is the attraction of turning your attention to the city issues?
Well, I think even as a state senator, getting things done at the state level, that I also focus on the city as well. But as a city council person, I focused on the city. This is an opportunity to lead our city in a direction that I think will be in the best interest of all people. I think public service is public service. But when you have leadership skills and you have the broad range of experience that I have, I think I am the right person to lead the city in the right direction and the person who can bring all of us together, working with all of the various silos in the city, whether it is the education community, the business community, the community in general, those who are involved in public service, social services. You know, I've had experience in all of those areas, having served on 23 different boards in this city. I think I know our city pretty well, but more importantly, I think that I'm a good listener, because I always tell people good ideas became great ideas when you work with other people. I think I started the Baltimore Marathon some 15 years ago because I was looking at one specific issue, and that was the fact that this city had a 38% adult illiteracy rate. And what I really was looking to do was to create a funding stream for literacy programs to be developed throughout the city. The marathon currently has a $40 million impact on the city because I didn't look at it just from that perspective. I looked at it from the perspective of what would a marathon do for Baltimore in terms of bringing tourism into the city, increasing revenue for the city. So I look at things probably like many other people do, but when I look at Baltimore, I see the glass as half full. I see an opportunity to reconfigure our city that was once 1 million people, now 620,000. I see the opportunity to create senior living communities in our city where people will feel comfortable moving around our city. I see an opportunity to light up our city so people can feel safe walking around our neighborhoods. I see the opportunity to create jobs and reach out into other aspects of our city and our state and nationally to bring jobs and create business opportunities and to be more inclusive in how we develop and continue to expand our city.
You ran for mayor also in 2011,
absolutely,
right? How have your priorities changed? How have your goals changed since then?
Let me just say, if someone were to ask me what is the key thing that I'd want to do in my lifetime, it would be being mayor of this city, because it is a very mayoral-run city. I think my focus has not changed in terms of the education needs of the city, the desire to reduce unemployment in the city, to create more jobs, to create a 21st century education system. I built the first new school in Baltimore with my partners, both Steve Ziger and Fred Lazarus, in 30 years, the Baltimore Design School. I want every school to look like the Baltimore Design School. It is a public school, but we have our own board of directors, and those board of directors don't necessarily have children in the school. But we've infused resources in that school to make it a first-class school for our young people.
And you think the board of directors is a big part that kind of support for a school?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think we have the first-class labs that we have in our school. New sewing machines in our classrooms, new computers in every classroom, water fountains at work, brand new facility. No, I think that the public school system has certainly played a role in making sure that we build the right kind of building for our students, but certainly the outside help and the resources of the board of directors has made a difference in that school.
That the building there in Station North, where the School of Design is, was pretty much, I don't know whether it's fair to call it abandoned, but it certainly was not in line to have this kind of use. How do you see doing that on a more widespread scale in the city?
Well, first of all, we have monies coming into the Baltimore City Public School System to build 23 new schools in the city, and we will do
that.
But
I'm talking about transforming.
Well, transforming a neighborhood.
Transforming the shells.
Well, we took advantage of historical tax credits. We took advantage of, because we were a transformation public school, that the school system owed us a building, so we actually borrowed money on a 30-year lease to redevelop that building, and that's what we've ended up with. And I think you can do that in other communities and in other neighborhoods, but the fact of the matter is that this session we were able to get monies to build new schools in Baltimore. But we want similar type schools in every neighborhood. No child should have to walk into a building and not have air conditioning or sit in a classroom that's 100 degrees or 90 degrees. We believe that our children deserve the very best, and if we're going to be a part of a first-class education system that this state proposes to have, then we have to make sure that the resources are available for all of our students.
At State Senator Catherine Pugh here on Midday on WYPR. She is one of 10 Democrats who is running for the Democratic nomination to be mayor. The election, the primary is next April. And you can share your questions with State Senator Catherine Pugh. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. You talked about state money for the rebuilding of some schools. There was also about $12 million, $11.6 million in education funds that Governor Hogan has kept from coming to the Baltimore schools. Governor Hogan, a Republican, also canceled Baltimore's light rail project, the Red Line. In October, he unveiled plans for a high-speed bus system for the city. What sitting as you do in the state Senate and now looking at being mayor of Baltimore, what is your sense about whether Governor Hogan is invested in improving life in Baltimore?
Let me just say, I think we have a responsibility as leaders of Baltimore City to make it clear what our case is for Baltimore City, that we do need education dollars, that a transportation system halfway done is not enough. While there were people who agreed or disagreed with the red line, the big issue here was the creation of jobs and opportunities and trying to make sure that people were able to get from one end of the city to the other or where the job opportunities prevail. The rapid bus system certainly is something that is needed, but you can't put in a rapid bus system without vetting it with all of the community groups and organizations. Like I've already heard from those in the Waverly community who said that, you know, if you make the changes up there, it makes it very difficult for business. So you can't just put something on a board and draw it out and say, this is what the community needs. It's got to be fully vetted. But I think that's about relationship building. I have a relationship with the governor because he is the governor, and we want to make sure that we have the resources in the city, and I will make that case, and certainly will others. We will come back to this General Assembly asking for our funds, working towards our funds. And, you know, every session is a negotiation session. You know, there are certain things that the administration will want, and there's certainly some things that we in Baltimore will continue to want. We want a first-class education system, and we will continue to fight for it. There is a formula that is in place. It just does not respond to Baltimore City, but it is responsive to every jurisdiction in the state. And so we believe that it's a little bit unfair to leave a session and changes take place when we go to session for that 90-day period to balance a budget. And so we'll be back in January 13th, to work on those issues.
But are you hopeful of a different result this session than you got last session and after the session?
Well, we got what we wanted when we left session. The changes took place after we left session. We left session with the intent of receiving the education dollars that we needed. We also left session looking forward to the light rail, even though all of those questions, the red line, even though all of those questions were not responded to before we left the session, that discussion was still on the table. I think I was not the only person who was surprised that the red line was taken off the table. Certainly our federal leaders were as surprised and our city leaders were as surprised. So we're hoping that when we go back to session, that $900 million is gone. That train has already left, but we will still go back to Annapolis fighting for the kind of transportation system that this city needs.
And do you think Governor Hogan's CityLink plan for 12 high-frequency buses would do enough to address Baltimore's transportation issues?
Well, I'm already hearing from community groups and organizations, as I said a little bit earlier, that are not pleased with some of the changes. Those changes have to be vetted, and that's why many of those changes won't take place until 2017, because you've got to vet those changes with the community groups and organizations. You've got to make sure, you know, our school system, for example, contributes about $6 million to the public transportation to make sure that our children get to school. We don't know what the impact of the changes on the bus routes will do for our children getting to school on time. We've got children who get up as early as, who start traveling to school as early as 6 and 6:30 a.m. in the morning. So, again, the community groups and organizations will have an opportunity to vet the rapid bus system.
You talked about making the case in Annapolis for the city's needs. How would you summarize the city's challenges in the wake of what happened in April? In the wake of the unrest, the protests, the riot?
Well, you know, one of the things I continue to say, because I was out there every single day during the unrest, that what people saw on television was not all of Baltimore, but what it did show us was that there are parts of the city that have been neglected for decades that still look like a war zone. And so we need the resources to fix up these neighborhoods, and we need to figure out how we balance our wealth in our city and how we are more inclusive in our development. You know, if we can do what we need to do as it relates to downtowns, and we need a great downtown. And the reason we need a great downtown is because it's a tourism trade, and that's a big part of our economy in Baltimore. But at the same time, we can't neglect neighborhoods in Northwest Baltimore. We're doing a lot of work over in East Baltimore, and you're seeing some of the work starting to take place in West Baltimore. But we also got to create the jobs and the opportunities inside the communities. And one of the things I continue to say to the nonprofit community more specifically, who make contributions to different groups and organizations, that, you know, we can't just look at one part of town or into specific communities. We have to be more broader in terms of how we make selections to be inclusive in the distribution of opportunities to these communities who are desperately in need.
I want to ask you more about all of that, especially about jobs. We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with State Senator Catherine Pugh, running for the Democratic nomination to be mayor. She is with us the rest of the hour. You can be, too. I'll remind you of our phone number in just a bit. But first, there's another number I'd like you to focus on this last day of WIPR's fundraising drive. Andy Beanstock, what is that number? Hi, we're back. Sheila Cast here on Midday with State Senator Catherine Pugh, one of the Democratic candidates vying to be Baltimore's next mayor. I want to pick up on where we were talking about business. You have a background in business.
Yes.
You worked as a banker. You own a consignment store.
Also was the worked at the Council for Equal Business Opportunities, where I helped to grow and expand businesses all over the city through Sam Daniels's office. We worked day and night growing businesses all over the city.
And you are president of CEP and Company, marketing and public relations firm.
Yeah.
So I know you look at a lot of these issues from a perspective of business. Let's talk to Janet in Baltimore, who has some questions about business. Janet, welcome to Midday.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon, Sheila and Senator Pugh. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
That was a great segue into my question, because I do want to know what Senator Pugh's specific plans. I know you can't give me the whole process,
okay,
but how you plan to expand businesses in the more blighted area.
Okay.
I personally live in Southwest Baltimore, right off of Frederick Avenue. And I see so much potential around here.
I'm with you, Janet.
Yeah,
I see a lot
of
great potential. And in fact, we opened up a consignment store down on Washington Boulevard for the same reason that, you know, there are a lot of empty storefronts, but we need to fill them with businesses. But one of the things I'm looking at, and it was a proposal that I put together, and I've shared it with the Baltimore Development Corporation and some others, and that is to begin to invest in people who live in our city. And let me tell you why. And that's how we can fill up some of these corridors. If, for example, and I'm sure you visited the market on Sunday underneath of 83, or you go over to 33rd Street, or even if you go up to Mondawmin, you'll see people on carts. And I said, why not offer opportunities to those individuals to take part in those many of those businesses that don't have anybody, these empty storefronts all over our city? So the proposal that I put together said, you know, we can jumpstart a number of businesses, up to 100 new businesses a year, by just going to the people who live in our city. And the data will show you that if you invest in people who live in your city and build businesses from within, that the dollars stay into your community more quickly, will stay in your businesses more often. So here's what I'm looking at. For example, in Pigtown, where we're located, instead of opening up one
Pigtown
business...
Pigtown is where your consignment store...
Yes, where the consignment store is. Instead of opening up one business at a time, we open up 10 businesses. You can go to areas like in Canton, like in Federal Hill, and even in Hamden, and offer people second locations or help people to jumpstart their own businesses. And so we put together a proposal where we will allow for grants to be delivered to individuals who are interested in expanding or growing their businesses. And then if they establish a five-year lease with us, they would get a certain stipend for the first year. If they stay there through that five-year period, for that second 5 years, we would give them another stipend. And what it totaled up to be, and I've shared this with the Main Street groups, and they're very excited about it, is that for less than $5 million a year, you could jumpstart 100 new businesses. But when we started talking about this, Department of Social Services said to us, well, you know, if they are barbershops and beauty salons or nail salons or whatever retail establishments, we can help to buy the resources for those individuals. And then the office
I'm not sure I follow. We can help to buy the resources for those individuals.
For example, if it's a barber chair or a beauty chair, they can help you with
some of the equipment that a business might need to get started.
And then the Office of Employment Development, we're looking at them in terms of developing a retail training program where you can help to employ the people who will work in those various businesses. But it goes beyond that. And when you talk about, for example, the school buildings that are emptying out in these neighborhoods, why not look at how to repurpose these buildings before we just empty them out and leave another deserted building in community? So I have a proposal working with the various entities throughout the city that I think investing in the people in the city will drive business and grow business in the city.
Janet, I appreciate your call, but I think I have read, Senator Pugh, that you've set out a goal of 25,000 new jobs in Baltimore. Baltimore
looking
over
at 10 how do
years?
We create 25,000 jobs. Just that project alone will create something like 4,000 new jobs. But then when you talk about looking at manufacturing and some of the biotech industries, making sure that they have opportunities to grow in our city. For example, I just got a email from a gentleman who told me thank you because I made sure that Morgan State University was included in the research grants so that they can create opportunities in business. They just got their first patent, which will create thousands of jobs in Baltimore City. When you look at the number of boarded up houses in our city, why not look at how do we create business opportunities around rehabbing some of those neighborhoods or giving those houses away to people in our communities who are interested in rebuilding our neighborhoods? That too will create jobs. And then again, with the resources that I have working nationally and internationally, I was just over to the Japanese embassy talking about manufacturing opportunities that they can provide for our city. I was just up in Annapolis where we're going to create more solar opportunities in our city, which is going to produce more jobs and job opportunities for people living in Baltimore. We have to do this because we've got to equalize wealth and create opportunities and provide jobs for the people who are unemployed and the people who want to move to other levels in our city. And we can do that.
Time is moving by so quickly, and of course, I want to ask you about the police department and about crime. 322 murders so far this year, 27 in the past 30 days. So essentially, we're talking about a murder a day seems to be what's normal now in Baltimore. We got an email from Michael in Remington who wants to know, how would you improve the Baltimore Police Department? How would you get guns off the streets of Baltimore? And Shay in Baltimore is on the phone to ask a similar question. Shay, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, your question.
I have a question for Senator Pugh. And it's in line with the question about the police department. In light of the Freddie Gray case and all of the discourse that we have in Baltimore, we obviously need police. And what are you going to do to repair the relationship in the police department to make people actually want to go into law enforcement? Mm-hmm. What you're going to do to make police want to patrol our neighborhoods, want to do a better job.
Well, Shay, I appreciate the call. Senator Pugh.
Thank you, Shay. I appreciate the call as well. I think it's a number of things that we can do. First of all, I am serving on this police commission, and we are looking at all of these issues.
This is the Public Safety and Policing Work Group of the General Assembly. You are co-chairing that.
Yes. And so a number of things have come up. First of all, we've learned that less than 25% of our police force actually live in our city. And so we want to make sure that we're recruiting more police officers to live in our city. And I think the mayor just released a program to increase the incentives for police officers to buy homes in the city. One of the things I'm working with the real estate community is making sure that rents are lowered for police officers, because if you're 21 years old and you're coming out of the police academy, more than often you can't even afford to buy a house. And so we're talking with the real estate community, and they're very excited about that possibility. Also, making sure that police officers who live in our city can also take their cars home. But what she talked about was, how do we get the police to respect the community? And more importantly, I think together, the community to respect the police. And I was having this discussion over in Washington this morning, and I said, one of the things that we don't do anymore is we don't encourage young people at an early age to understand the role of public safety, because it's not just about policing. It's about being a part of the community. When I was growing up, we had public safety patrol among the young people. And we don't do that anymore, to have the police officers engage with the young people at an early age. So we want to do that. We used to have the Police Athletic League, and we need to do that. And I see more engagement by this police department currently with our communities. But it really is not just about what we need police officers to do. It's what we need to do in our own communities. You know, while we are upset about what happened with with Freddie Gray, what we're talking about right now is the fact that we have so much criminal activity going on in our communities. That discussion has to be had among members of our community. Black-on-black crime is high in our neighborhoods and in our communities, so we have to take on some responsibility as well, having those conversations with our community. We are looking at, and I'm talking with the police commissioner, around reform as it relates to gun control and getting guns off of our streets and not letting those who are repeat offenders who have illegal guns be allowed to walk our streets with illegal guns. We can't arrest our way out of the problems that we have, but we can begin to have discussions around how we respect each other. But the other issue that has come up with this police commission, I was just reading the report this morning, was about how do we evaluate and train our officers to be more culturally sensitive, to be more equipped to be able to serve people, because that's what they are. They're actually our public servants. But we got to make our streets safer. We've got to light up our neighborhoods so that people feel safe walking down our streets. But the training has to be there. The training has to be in the police department that equips them with cultural sensitivity.
You think it's not there now?
Oh, we know that it's not there now, but we know that it is changing, because when I talk with our police commissioner, I talk with the president of the police association from around the state who was on the panel with me this morning, he said some of the changes that we're making are okay, but and some of them are just not enough. When we talk about the period of time in which police officers have under the Police Bill of Rights, we know that that will be shrunken down. We know transparency is needed, more inclusiveness by the community in terms of oversight. So I think you'll see those changes. We will be meeting again in January to talk about some of the things that we need to do, but we're listening to the community. It's important to listen to the community as well as to listen to the police department as well, because it's a two-way street.
That is State Senator Catherine Pugh here on Midday on WYPR. She's going to be with us for a few more minutes. There's still time for you to send us an email if you have a question for her. Midday@WYPR.org is our email. Our phone number here at Midday is 410-662-8780. As I said, we're going to take a short break, and I want you to maybe jot that phone number now down. But right now, because we are wrapping up here at WYPR, this is the last day of our fundraiser. There is another phone number I want you to focus on right now, and here's Andy Bienstock with that. Hi, we're back here on Midday. I'm Sheila Cast in the studio with State Senator Catherine Pugh, who's one of the Democrats vying to be Baltimore's next mayor. I want to go straight to Jason in Baltimore, who for Jason, I hope a quick comment about something that Senator Pugh said in a couple minutes ago. Jason, welcome.
Hi. I wanted to take issue with the notion of giving business opportunities in, say, Pigtown to, you know, rich yuppies from Canton or Federal Hill. The city should take the time and make the investment to find people in the community who have the initiative and, you know, the drive to, you know, learn how to become a business owner, because that's what's going to make those communities revitalize.
Jason, I don't think that's what the senator was saying.
I think he misconstrued what I said, because what I said was, like Canton and like Federal Hill, there are businesses, and like in Pigtown, where there are storefronts, there are Carters all across the city. And what I gave was examples of where you could find such opportunity, people who are looking for those opportunities. I said you could go over to Mont Dahmin. You could look, for example, under the bridge of 83 on a Sunday morning, or you can go over to 33rd Street and you'll see a number of entrepreneurs in training as I see them, as well as on Druid Hill Park on during the summer months, where people come out and showcase their wares because they're business people who want opportunity. So what I was talking, what I gave was an example of where some businesses are in terms of what it is we want the rest of the city to look like. There are entrepreneurs all over the city who are crying for help and who would love the opportunity to go in business. And what I cited was a program that I had put together that looked at giving those opportunities to individuals who live in our city who want to grow their businesses, and providing grant opportunities to those individuals, not to individuals who already have businesses, unless they want to expand and be second and third locations.
I appreciate your clarifying that. Let me ask you about another business. business topic. We have just a couple of minutes left, but tax increment financing, the tax breaks that developers get and investors then get paid off by the city's property taxes. What is your view of what should be done with that? At what level, if any, should they continue?
Well, one of the things I believe that is if we can do tax incremental financing to develop and expand downtowns, we ought to be able to do tax incremental financing to develop and expand other parts of our city, whether it is Park Heights or North Avenue. But also, I think that we need to look at how do we reduce property taxes in the city so that we can increase people living in our city and provide opportunities for people to live in our city, whether it is reducing taxes if they would start working on certain parts of our city. I'm talking about individuals. If we were offering, for example, a house in a neighborhood that's been abandoned for a number of years, maybe there's a special taxing program for those individuals who want to invest and live in those neighborhoods. But tax incremental financing should not just be for one part of the city. If we're going to do this kind of thing, it has to be more broader and it has to be more inclusive.
Can the city, with its budget pressures, afford any of it?
Well, I think as the mayor of this city, you have a responsibility to evaluate all of the finances of the city. And I think that that's one of the things that we have to look at in terms of our city. Let's take our budget, turn it inside out, upside down, and see what the city can afford to do and how do we do it in such a way that we're more inclusive.
And on that point, one last quick email from Vinny in Baltimore. How will you interact and engage with the various social movements in the city to ensure that the voices of disenfranchised individuals are heard by the people in power and are taken seriously?
Well, first of all, I think we have to listen. I think that's a part of being a mayor. You have to listen to everybody who lives in your city. Everybody in the city has to feel that they are part. Everybody has to feel that they're invested in moving the city forward. And I will listen. I will not be a in-city hall mayor. I'll be a walk-around mayor. I'll be in your community. I will be sitting down with your groups. You call, I respond. Because I believe that that's the only way that you move a city forward. When I worked for William Donald Schaefer, one of my responsibilities was, my title was Director of Citizens Involvement. My responsibility was to go out into the neighborhoods and in the communities, listen to people and create programs that made people feel safe about their neighborhoods. I created neighborhood watches and operation identification programs in the city. The mayor has to be the mayor of all people, everyone. If we're going to have first-class schools in this city, that means the mayor has to listen. If we're going to create jobs and opportunities, that means the mayor has to listen to the business community, work with the colleges and universities and institutions in this community. You have to work with all of the groups. The young people have to feel that this is their city too, and they're invested. So you have to listen to them. We want to create an opportunity for youth to sit at the table. I tell people it's from the suites to the streets. Everybody has a role in Baltimore, and we're going to move forward with me as your next mayor, working with everyone and on behalf of all of our citizens.
State Senator Catherine Pugh, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you.
We will continue to speak to other candidates in coming weeks, and you can listen back to interviews we've done with several candidates at the Midday webpage, midday@wypr.org. Now we're going to get an update on the trial of Officer William Porter, one of the six Baltimore police officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Yesterday, Officer Porter took the stand to testify in his defense. He stated he did not call an ambulance because Freddie Gray did not give a reason for needing medical attention. Instead, Porter told Officer Goodwin, the driver of the van, that a trip to the hospital was needed. Kenneth Burns, WIPR's reporter who's been covering this trial, is with us on the line. Kenny, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Sheila.
When did Officer Porter say that he discovered that Freddie Gray was unresponsive?
We're going back to around, let's start with, it sounds like you're referring to the fourth stop. This is the one where Officer Goodson asked for someone to come out to assist and check on Porter at Fifth at Dolphin and Drew Hill Avenue. Bear with me as I go back to my notes.
Well, I didn't mean to throw you back into the trial. Why don't I just take advantage of the fact that you've been following this testimony so closely? What is the latest and the most important thing for us to know about what the testimony is today?
Well, today in particular, we've heard from a couple of expert witnesses. The first one was a neurological surgery expert or a neurosurgeon, Dr. Matthew Ammerman from Washington, D.C. He largely testified that he too disagrees with the medical examiner's opinion that the injury took place between the second and fourth stop, the second stop being when officers took Freddie Gray out of the back of the police van in order to put leg shackles on him and then put him back in. And then the fourth stop is that medical check. This is the one where Officer Porter responded to at Druid Hill and Dolphin. He believes it's not possible because...
It's not possible that the injury occurred that early.
Right. It's not possible that the injury occurred that early because it would have been impossible for him to breathe. He said that Gray suffered a, quote, catastrophic spinal cord injury, which would have prevented him from breathing.
And so he thinks that must have occurred later, in a later
stop. He did not
say
specifically when when he thought the injury occurred, but he did say it did not happen between the second and fourth stops.
Well, whose responsibility does Porter say it was that Gray receive medical attention?
The defense's theory, which is also the theory of the expert witness that we just heard from, Police Chief Timothy Longo from Charlottesville, Virginia, he said that it was the responsibility of the van driver, in this case, Officer Cesar Goodson, who will be on trial next month.
And the state has had a chance to cross-examine Porter. What came from that?
Cross-examining Porter, that took place yesterday as well. Porter was on the stand for 4.5 hours just about, and Porter was really pressed by Deputy State's Attorney Michael Schatzo as far as his role in checking on Gray and making and not doing enough to get medical help for Gray. He asked about seatbelting a prisoner. He asked about whether he was familiar with orders from the police department in regards to putting detainees in a seatbelt. One of the smaller turning points that really snowballed was when Michael Schatzo asked Officer Porter to compare the previous order, which would be Order K-14 from almost 2 decades ago. This is the one where it says that seatbelting a detainee is within the officer's discretion based on his safety. And then the updated order, which was released to officers 3 days before Gray was arrested, that required all detainees to be placed in a seatbelt. And it also had instructions on what happens when you take a detainee to a hospital. And Porter said that he relied on his previous training as in regards to how he handled the situation with Freddie Gray. And there was nothing in the old order or the previous order that dictated hospital how long you should be or do a hospital detail.
Kenny, we're out of time here. I know you're going to have a fuller report for us on All Things Considered this evening, so I really appreciate your taking time to talk to us right now. Thanks.
No problem.
And also thanks to Eddie's of Roland Park for lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles and on Roland Avenue. More details at www.eddiesofrolandpark.com. Tomorrow on Midday, a news roundup. We hope you will join us for that. But today, if you have not already made a pledge to WIPR, we hope you'll consider doing that. And here's Andy Beanstock with a number.